All right, this should be the last week of this series of studies that we've been doing on the nature of sin and the covenants. And I'll do a review of last week that Brian presented, which largely dealt with several chapters of Romans, as we deal with this question of whether or not human beings are born guilty of sin, having inherited some guilt from Adam, and whether along with that corresponding to it, we have some internal programming that we get from Adam that forces us or takes us into sin over the course of our life that we can't avoid, as the Calvinist point of view has to say. And so in Romans, the reason we're looking at it is because these are the main passages that people would go to try to support this doctrine of inherited guilt and sinful programming. And so that's why we went to spend so much time on it. Without these passages in Romans, there's really not very much at all that you could use to develop a doctrine like this in Scripture. It's certainly not really present in the Old Testament at all. So Romans 5, I'm just going to sum up what I think is going on in each of these passages. So Romans 5 essentially, I think, lays out this idea that if we follow the pattern of Adam and sin, we receive the same result, which is condemnation unto death. Death passes to all men in that pattern as all men sin. It's essentially what Paul says in that part. So it's not an inheritance, it's a pattern of behavior that you follow. Paul is not tracing this back to your lineage. He's simply using Adam as an illustration of a pattern, as he does for Christ later. And in that respect, that both Adam and Christ function in the same way in this passage as far as Paul is concerning them. Now, to different ends, but they function in the same way. They are both archetypes of a pattern. They are the exemplar of a pattern. So, since it's true that Christ does not ensure that all men have a program that stops them from sinning in all cases, then it is not true that it is also the case that Adam does not function as a transmitter of some programming that makes you sin. See, you can't have one without the other. They're functioning in the same way towards mankind.
Yes. Say that again.
I think I didn't articulate it very well when I came around the second time. Christ does not instill a programming in us that prevents us from sinning. Neither does Adam instill a program in us that forces us to sin. So Christ does not force you to do righteousness, neither does Adam force you to sin. And so these two have to operate in the same way. So whatever is true for Adam must be true for Christ. If you know that Christ does not instill some programming in all men, it has to be all men. Christ does not instill a programming in all men that immediately makes it so that all men can no longer sin, then neither does Adam instill a program in all men that makes it so that all men must sin. So that right there causes problems for the Calvinist scheme, which certainly does not hold that all men are immediately unable to sin in Christ. So Romans 6... we have this concept of slavery or service or servitude to sin. And in this case, we have, again, we have to look at the parallels. So to be a slave to Christ does not mean that you are unable to sin. I think all of us can say that's the case as Christians. We're trying to be...
Certainly Paul there is writing in Romans 6 out of a concern that they may sin and wanting to admonish them not to sin, which...
So
presupposes that they still have the capacity to choose sin.
If you're a slave to Christ, and that doesn't mean you're unable to sin, then being a slave to sin doesn't mean you're unable to do good, as Calvinism teaches. We are wholly unable to incline ourselves toward anything good or to prepare ourselves in any way to receive the gospel. Not true. Then you certainly couldn't use this passage to support that concept. And Paul throughout this is using the idea of yield yourselves to Christ. Don't yield yourselves to sin, right? That's an idea of involving or invoking your voluntary choice and decision of what you would do. He couldn't say that if you were on some sort of program. Programs don't have a choice about whether they want to follow the command of the system. But here he's saying you should choose to follow Christ or you should not yield yourself to sin. not something that it speaks of the kind of servitude and programming that Calvinism has in mind. And lastly, Romans 7, which we have a little bit more. Paul says that we start out alive, not dead to sin from birth. We start out alive before we have a knowledge of the law. That would not be possible in a Calvinist scheme in which all babies inherit from Adam a death sentence and guilt of sin. Paul says, I started out, I was alive once before the law. So that's a problem. He explains throughout the course of the chapter that sin comes into our lives, into us, when by the law we come to a knowledge of what is sinful, and then we are tempted and engage in that sinful behavior. That's when sin comes into us, as Paul describes it, when we birth sin, essentially, into our lives. And James says similarly, it's not from Adam. He doesn't say sin comes into our lives when we are born because we get it from Adam like you would genes. He doesn't use any kind of description of that sort. Instead, he traces it back to our behavior in response to coming to a knowledge of the law, which we don't start out with this understanding. And that guilt, therefore, as he upholds, requires this knowledge and understanding, which is not present in children and is not inherited from Adam. Neither the knowledge nor the guilt. He says that even now, after we have essentially known sin in our own experience, having chosen sin, we are not. We still have the will to do what's right, and we still delight in the law of God in his case. So Calvinism has this idea that you're wholly depraved, you're entirely, totally depraved, and unable to do anything good. But Paul is saying that even those who have engaged in sin have a will to do what's right. And one of the things we had mentioned several weeks ago after study, I know it was here, was, you know, if you have a team that goes, a football team that goes 15-1, over the course of their season, 15 wins and one loss, you look at that and you go, that's a pretty successful football team. And I think that the case is that, sure, we all have sinned. We all sin periodically. But we're not all constantly sinning. And even conceptually, we have to distinguish between the difference between someone who's constantly sinning every minute of every day because of some internal programming that they're stuck with, and someone who occasionally sins, but for the most part, lives pretty well and does a pretty good job with their life. Even non-Christians somehow manage some of that. So the Calvinism needs it to be only one of those cases. It has to be constant and all the time. And so Paul explaining how we have this struggle, he's talking about how it's a struggle. Well, there's no struggle if you're programmed to sin. You just do it. Right? A computer following a command is not struggling over the moral choice to do what it's programmed to do. The struggle is because we're trying to resist. That attempt to resist is the attestation of the will to good in us.
I was going to say that, you know, even when we make an analogy that says, like, you know, 15-1, the point is not to say someone should think, well, I'm pretty good because I only sin once in a while. Obviously, that's not our intention.
Right, no.
Any sin is something that we need to root out. Any sin would be, I mean, look at Adam and Eve. You know, they're... Adam and Eve don't commit murder. They don't commit adultery. They disobey God with regard to this one rule that I think most people today would think is not... It doesn't seem to be such a horrifying violation. So any sin is something bad that will justify separating from you from God.
Sure.
But the point of sort of clarifying this, we're not all sinning all the time in a bunch of different ways, is to make stopping sin properly attainable, because it's out of reach when you put it in terms of us all constantly sinning all the time.
Right. And to recontext, the Paul's discussion here is pointing towards a struggle in which we are trying to do right, and we may ultimately fail from time to time, certainly. I'm not trying to justify that, but there's a difference between someone who fails occasionally and someone who fails constantly. And Jason?
I was just going to say, as part of this part of the review, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, looking into some of the stuff this week, even the August, really this is Augustinian.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not Calvinistic so much.
Well,
that's what's
Augustine didn't develop these things, I don't think, as clearly as they're articulated in the Westminster Confession, although the ideas are sort of there.
We trace it back to Augustine as well.
Yeah.
Just saying, some of the stuff I've seen was Augustine actually understood this problem with an infant being condemned, and that's where the infant baptism formula came from.
Mm.
But even the infant baptism formula still has within that argumentation that that's wiping out what Adam gave them, and then later on they have to, something else has to occur when they become the owner, have
as
their
an
own
adult
sin.
Yeah,
they still have that element. They're just wiping out the original sin
right.
in this infant baptism problem. So
right.
anyway, I just
yeah, and that's
no
that.
Which,
that brings
no matter
up
which doctrine you're under, you still have the age onset sin.
True.
Problem.
And go ahead, John.
So, well, I guess I mean I don't want to try like. There's so many things I want to say and try to keep it as short as possible, but I mean, looking back, for me, the big one that stands out to me is like, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, the hermeneutical approach, and I mean, is there a chance that we're getting caught in an either or here? Is there a possibility that there's another option?
I think we always have to ask that question in any study. I hope that we have faced this with that kind of openness. I believe that in some cases, and I think this is one of them, that there simply are only two mutually exclusive options. You are either born guilty of sin, inheriting that from Adam, or you are not. I don't see a middle option there. You either have...
Okay, I'll give you one.
All right.
Okay, so you inherit what I would call the nature that you inherit, but you're not powerless. You still have the ability to overcome.
So are you guilty with that or not guilty when you're conceived?
No, I don't believe you're guilty because I still believe in the age.
Okay, so you're in the same category as we would be, as the model we've outlined
well,
there.
There's two questions. One
right.
is...
That's why I'm bisecting
one,
it.
But
yeah.
I was saying, like, one is guilty or not guilty at birth, and the other is...
Programming or not.
Do you have a sinful nature at birth or not? And right. and that's where you're coming in and saying, well, we're not guilty, but we may have a sinful nature.
You can't be guilty at birth because you're not at the age of accountability yet.
Right. So you don't inherit guilt
because you haven't done anything.
So
right, I mean you.
So let's get to the question of programming.
5:6, the word strength there, which is the one we were talking about. So look at the word strength: weak, ill, of physical weakness or illness, of moral or spiritual weakness. So there's obviously a moral or spiritual weakness at the beginning.
Well, it's a. I would question that because certainly the Greek word.
Which where are you at?
So it's 772 strength.
With the base
which verse though.
Romans 5:6.
Just to lay this out again, I think it came up in a different question last week. The basic Greek word has to do with the same connotations as the basic English word weak. You can apply it in different contexts to say that person has a weak character or that person has weak bodily strength. It has a concept of being without strength. Now, moral weakness implies a certain thing, but the New Testament introduces this concept, not introduces, but discusses this concept of the weakness of the flesh. I agree that the flesh is weak. I think every non-Calvinist agrees that there is a weakness that is a part of the flesh that we inherit as a result of being descendants of Adam and Eve. No doubt about that. That creates, as we've said, an opportunity for sin and temptation to do things to fulfill what the flesh would like or wants in ways that are not what God would allow. But that's the weakness. The question is, does it go beyond that to discussing some sort of moral failing in our ability to choose right? And so I just wanted to put the conversation, at least on that footing, from my perspective.
Well, you know, I think the question is, when Paul says it, you know, while we are yet without strength, is he's clearly contrasting prior to our conversion to Christianity to the present time, right? So it's not the case that when you get converted that your flesh is somehow any less weak than it was before, right? The only way you would truly overcome that kind of weakness of the flesh is through the transformation to immortality, right? Because my body still has needs and cravings, et cetera, et cetera. So if he's not talking about that, then I think, you know, if you look at this word here, it means... sorry, I lost the definition. It can mean weak, infirm, or feeble. And you look at the number of times that it's used throughout the New Testament, and a lot of times it's translated as sick. And so I think the idea here is while we were yet sick, in the sense that Jesus says elsewhere, they that be whole do not need a physician, but they that are sick, which is sort of paralleled by this idea where he goes on here and say, they that are whole have no need of a physician, but they that are sick, I came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. So the idea here is that the weakness here refers to this still engaged in sinful behavior, that's sort of a sickness.
Sure.
It doesn't,
But I think
it's using sickness as a metaphor.
But you can inherit sickness from a parent, can't you? So, I mean, you have to address that in light of the question that John's raising, which is you could inherit sickness or illness from congenital or from transmission from a parent. You can also acquire sickness. So then the question still isn't answered by the use of the word. I'm just trying to relate it back to the main question he's bringing up.
But John is asking whether or not Romans 5:6, because of it says without strength, infers necessarily because of that language that there's some inherent weakness in humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And once you acknowledge that it's using the concept of sickness here, potentially in a metaphorical sense, that these sicknesses can be inherited from parents, but they can also be acquired, then you've removed the necessary connotation because now you have the option to be either or.
But look at the object after that. For the ungodly. So that's why I'm saying there's something more there than, you know, sick or feeble. That's why I'm trying to tie the moral part to it there, because it comes back and says, in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. So it's ungodly is who he died for. That seems to point more towards the spiritual thing.
I mean, anybody who sins, whether it's Adam and Eve taking from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, or a person engaging in murder, they're ungodly by virtue of the sin. It doesn't imply any inherent weakness prior to that in humanity, because as we pointed out before, at the moments before Adam and Eve sinned, they had no sinful nature. They could not have had a sinful nature. Whatever weakness they had in their flesh was there from God's creation. It wasn't a result of a sinful choice. This reference to the ungodly here, to me, is all it necessarily refers to, and its basic connotation is people who are sinning. And this phrase, while we are yet weak or sick, speaking simply of the idea that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, essentially, which would be another phrase you'd find in the New Testament. So it's simply attesting to the fact that we were sin. I don't think the language necessarily infers that there's an inherent weakness.
Yeah, there's not. Even these concepts, weakness, sickness, unless you can find a verse that clearly is attesting to the idea that we get that transmitted to us from Adam, then I would say that that you're not able to get this. And there's certainly present in here the possibility throughout the rest of the New Testament that we acquire the sickness by bad habits, which anyone can. You can become unhealthy in your life through bad habits. And in the Old Testament, the concept of inherited guilt and sin from Adam is simply not present, certainly not in the earliest chapters of Genesis and then carrying forward through Moses. So,
in fact, just two verses later, Romans 5:8 almost translates this for us. So Romans 5:6 says, "For when we were yet without strength, while we were yet sick, in due time Christ died for the ungodly." And then verse 8 says, "In that yet while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us." So I think that word that's translated as without strength or feeble or in the sense of infirmed is simply being used metaphorically by Paul to refer to the fact that while we were still sinners. He didn't come when we were sinless, he came when we were sinners.
Sure, and I don't think it's too far removed to keep dancing around it, but what we've contracted is that condition of being a sinner when we engage in that first sin.
Right, so that's the question is there anything in the language of infirmed here that implies an inherent weakness in the flesh? Or it could be something, or does the Greek language allow it for be something that's contracted when we engage in sinful behavior ourselves?
And I think this dances around also the concept that what did Christ die for? There's a reversal of a death sentence happening here, because sin brought death, and the ransom is the ransoming of what he's paid for us to inherit eternal life, right? So, and then he provides the model through his life on how we should live.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there. To me, the cure for the contracted sickness of sinning is what he did. He died for us. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, he provides the antidote, and we can describe that. And we did in our redemption study talk more about that. Yeah, I mean, everybody agrees that this sinful. The sinful situation that you're in as a person, whatever you want to call it, is contracted. The question is, do you contract it from behavior you've engaged in, as you might from some kinds of diseases, or did you contract it from contact with someone else, in this case we might say congenitally from your parent, like a baby would know. Well, so In the case of Adam and Eve, what?
We have no choice. It wasn't contracted from others around them.
Well, they did not contract it from anyone. They developed it. One question we've asked again and again is, why do you need this concept of a sinful nature to explain sin? It happens for Adam and Eve without it. They have the weakness of the flesh, as Brian's pointed out, because they are mortal, and their flesh has things that it wants. But you don't need a sinful nature to explain Adam and Eve's sin. Why do you need one to explain mine? Unless the Bible is clearly asserting one somewhere in language that cannot conform to the idea of a pattern of developed sin.
I've got an answer for that.
Yeah.
So I believe it's different. And why do I believe it's different? Because in the study, when I went back through to the actual study and started looking at what you guys lay out, like, I got a problem with Genesis because, what is it, Genesis 5:3? Mm-hmm. Because you point to that as the one that says, hey, you know, with this right here, here's a straight proof. You know, you can't get around this one. But if you look at 5:3, it says, and Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own likeness after his image and called his name Seth.
Yeah.
Well, who's his there?
It's definitely Adam's image.
Okay, so if Adam and Eve are the only ones that are not like us, they didn't have two people getting together, having intercourse, creating a child, and having birth, why couldn't there be a difference there? Why isn't
between Adam's image and Seth's image?
They're made in the image of God.
Okay, so let's set the standard for determination here. This isn't saying you're wrong. But I think what we need to find is, whether it's Genesis or somewhere in Romans or elsewhere, a passage that can only mean that it's inherited. Not a place
what's
where
inherited?
That sinful nature is inherited.
Okay.
We need to find a passage that can only mean that. To go to a passage, whether in Romans or Genesis and elsewhere, and say, isn't it possible that it could mean this here? It doesn't quite get us there, because if it's possible that it could mean that, but it's possible that it could mean it's something else, then we still lack that sort of definitive proof, that passage or series of passages that necessarily can only convey one thing.
So we need to go back to this Genesis 5:3. We brought this up to dispel what I think is the common Calvinist use of 5:3. I would never bring Genesis 5:3 as a proof from my point of view, because it doesn't actually help me.
That's what I mean too.
So the way you're presenting it almost presents it in the same way that I tried to argue against it, which is that God has an image. He passes that to Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve sinned. They're unable to pass that good image to their children, so they pass their own image, their sinful image, and that 5:3 is attesting to that. And I would argue that, and we did this in a previous week, so I'll just restate it very simply. In Genesis 9:6, after the flood, which is now over 1,000 years later, God says to Noah and his sons that man is in God's image. He still attests to that as the reason they can't take man's life in murder. They can't murder another man. That's an attestation that even after the flood, man is still made in God's image. That image is still present in each man. So you can't have...
And I would say it this way, that the interpretation of Genesis 5:3, which says that Adam now passes on a sinful image to Seth, is predicated upon the idea that Adam is not capable of and does not pass on God's image to Seth. And Genesis 9:6 disproves that by demonstrating that generations later, men were still receiving the image of God from their forefathers in each generation.
And
so that Calvinist interpretation, what I call a Calvinist interpretation of Genesis 5:3 regarding Adam and Seth, is simply, I think, impossible based on Genesis 9:6.
Where I say it's not either or, it's and both. Why can't it be the image of God that is now tainted?
But why? What in the text is giving you the indication that it's tainted?
Because Adam and Eve were the first to sin, so even though they pass on the image that is of God...
But again, what in the text... I understand conceptually what you're saying, that the possibility that Adam and Eve's image or nature has been tainted, but what in the text of Genesis 5:3 indicates that what they're passing... I say that Adam and Eve's images were tainted. But see, in Genesis 1, throughout the passage of the introduction of the creation of animals, including Adam and Eve, they're to produce and multiply and fill the earth, etc., etc. And each of these kinds of being is to reproduce after their own. And so in the New Testament, for example, when it traces the lineage of Christ, it goes back to Adam in I think, Matthew's account, and it said that Adam's father was God. The lineage of man goes like that, to say... Adam has children after his kind and after his likeness. And Genesis 5:3 is simply an attestation of the fulfillment of God's command to Adam and Eve to reproduce and multiply, which is what that chapter is. Before that, you only know that they have three sons as far as you get the information, really. But this is, all this statement needs to be is an attestation that, like the other animals, Adam reproduced after his own kind. It doesn't, like it isn't for the other animals, an attestation of the moral character of those reproductions, those offspring. So what is it in the text that would incline us to think a simple phrase that Adam had a child in his image is an attestation of a sinful nature being transmitted, rather than the possibility, just equally likely, that a person who has sinned could produce an offspring who is innocent?
Well, I think the question is, does the phrase "in his own image" convey the pattern of kind reproducing their own kind, or does it convey something beyond that that includes a moral element? And that's where I think you're saying is, I don't see in the text where anything in the text would indicate a moral element when it could simply be indicating after the kind. And the passage that you're referring to is actually Luke, where it says, which was the son of Enosh, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God. Notice the exact parallel phrase there between Seth as the son of Adam and Adam as the son of God. And I would argue that the phrase the image of is intended to convey that the father passes on his image to the son.
We've talked in our other discussions about analysis about the difference, I think, between when a piece of evidence is correspondent to a theory and when that piece of evidence requires that theory. Something can be correspondent to more than one theory, right?
It could correspond to more than one explanation.
It can fit with it, right? So there are certain pieces of evidence that can only be explained by one theory and don't work at all with another theory. So we have to, in the case of Genesis 5:3, someone could surmise that it's possible that Genesis 5:3 could work with the interpretation that Adam passed a sinful nature to his child. It could be taken, if you interpret it a certain way, to correspond with that. But there's nothing, I don't think, in Genesis 5:3 that requires the point of view. And I'm not trying to stretch it. I'm saying linguistically, contextually, I don't see what would indicate that it would be beyond
that. I would say that
Jason had something he wanted to say when I was done.
But I don't, if you take the parallel phrase, or if you take the phrase that Adam is the son of God, and then you say, and Seth is the son of Adam, you don't go, oh my gosh, Seth is the son of Adam. I think that means something about the moral nature of Adam being passed on to Seth. You just go, no, it's about his reproductive origin from his father.
Also,
and I think that the phrase "image of" in Genesis is being used in that same way, and I don't know why you would read it and go, well, because the word "image" is used here, somehow there's automatically a moral connotation to it.
Right. Anyway, Jason, you had something I want to let John talk to if you have something to follow up.
He goes back to the exegetical hermeneutical principles that standing on its own, we don't see that in that lineage demarcation. We see what you've been saying. We only have the thought about the moral issue that we bring to that portion of Scripture because we know that. We know something happened with them being innocent, then they sinned. They appear to be different, you know, before and after. So then when it says Seth, so to me it's what we're bringing to that portion of Scripture that influences what we think about it.
John, I have a couple other thoughts too, so go ahead.
I mean, the big one for me is, I mean, I spent as much time as I could, but I don't have specific scripture to back it up, but I just want to lay a concept out there. So, as you follow from Genesis all the way through to the New Testament, at least what I perceive or what I see, is it's almost like God is continuing to let go. And I look at it like you print something in a copier, okay, and the first image is black. And it gets grayer and grayer and grayer. It's almost like God is like, okay, well, now this has happened, and now I'm letting these people experience this. Now this has happened, and I'm going to let the people experience this. And at some point, he's like, I've turned this thing over. You know, it is what it is. You know, you all have a reprobate mind. And this is just, you know, the concept, right?
Sure.
So bear with me. So it's like, and then at that point, however many, you know, generations happen after that before John Giannotti's born. But there's all this God almost just letting these things unwind and unravel over time. And then
there's so many generations before I'm ever born.
So are you suggesting that in that concept that, you know, maybe the first couple of generations of Adam pretty much still had a largely untainted programming, but then by the time you get to us, the programming is getting significantly awful?
I think it, I mean, at least conceptually, without
making fun of him.
Without going in and looking and having things to pull out and put there. I'm just saying, just from this week of study, just little things that I see comments, you know, I think they're mostly in Genesis as well.
I would counter that by saying that you would want to include in that consideration that God has, over the course of that same period of time, over history, reinfused the image back in. And I don't mean it in that sense, in the sense of your copy or model. The law of Moses, or the covenant with Noah, or Jesus Christ, for example, is God resetting the image, so to speak, to maintain the integrity of further copies in later generations. It maintains so that... in any sense, and I think that we... So I don't want to go too far back on it, but Don...
I just want to clarify a question for me. I think several weeks ago, I don't know if you said you're not a full Calvinist, you're not coming from all the tenets of Calvinism, and you're using the word program. I just want to make sure, are you using the word program? Do you believe it's just inherent, or do you believe it's the environment and the people? Just for my own clarification.
Like I said, I don't believe it's either or, I believe it's and both. Yes, I do believe... that when I was born, I had a nature about me.
Inherited program.
There was a spiritual nature about me that I inherited.
Okay.
Yes, I do believe.
I just want to
but
understand.
I don't believe that I am powerless at birth, or that I'm predestined, either, you know, that I'm going to go to hell. You know, I still believe that I have, you know, the ability to come to the knowledge of truth and be converted.
So how would you distinguish that concept of what you're, that nature that you're born with, from what our point of view is as we've articulated it?
You mean...
Because I certainly don't think that the humans are born with some tendency to sin. Is that the only difference? Because I believe that we develop that taste for it ourselves later on.
Well, I mean, that would be the question that I would have, would be, what would it look like if I took a baby and I had all these robots that I created, and I put them in this nursery, and this baby is only going to be attended to by pure, you know, great love and adoration, and there's no sin. This baby is brought up in a world of no sin. Would that baby sin? You know, if it was only taught good things.
So in your view, are you saying it would?
I say it would. I say it wouldn't matter.
Okay.
It wouldn't
matter
what situation that baby was in. It would eventually, something inside of it would propel it to make a bad decision. I don't think any human being can ever go, even if they were in a pristine environment, without ever sinning.
Okay.
Even if they were in a perfect environment, I don't think they could, and that's why, you know...
Adam and Eve couldn't, so I think your answer is in Adam and Eve somehow, because...
Well, how do you determine the...
I know Jason's getting a point, I just want to make sure it gets clarified.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Because what you're saying is that Adam and Eve didn't go through...
Something in how God created Adam and Eve, they had the propensity or the capability to do exactly what you just said. They were brought up in a pristine environment, other than the fact that the serpent came in and beguiled them.
Which I think...
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have the serpent. You wouldn't have this tree and all this other
so
stuff.
In the scenario that you're describing, given what Jason brought up and other factors that have been mentioned, how would you just scientifically determine which was the case, whether
saying,
it was an internal programming or not?
That's what I'm saying. There is no...
But I mean, like...
You're posing that rhetorically?
No, I mean it is a matter of... I'm not meaning it to challenge your point of view. I'm meaning it in a sense of... scientifically, you'd have to be able to determine how you could identify...
The only science that I would have would be my personal experience. My time before learning the knowledge of the truth of God and what my life looked like then after learning the truth...
But how do you tell the difference between a person who sins at some point eventually because of an internal programming that they were born with as compared to a person who develops a taste for it through learning, through example and experience and thinking about it and contemplating it without being born with a sinful nature? I mean, how would you discriminate between those two possible realities?
Because one would be a learned behavior and one would not be.
Right, but like when you look at the subjects that you're observing, how would you be able to determine which was the case, A or B?
I mean, it's the environment itself. If you didn't have anything that would allow a person to have a learned behavior to cause an action versus one where you did have the ability to have a learned behavior.
But over the course of real human history, we have no such environment.
Right.
So my question is, how biblically would you even,
I don't have a leg to stand on.
But I mean,
I think the environment of the garden. And the
but John Cena, he doesn't. You just said you don't think you'd have a leg to stand on there because you can't find evidence for it. You just think this is what you perceive to be the case based on your own life experience.
But what I'm saying is, I think we would all agree that without the inherited programming, that a person is likely to sin. I think this is certainly our view. But even without an inherent programming, they're going to sin. Most of us have, all of us have, over the course of human history, as a result of the other factors that we've mentioned that aren't related to internal programming. So we all, I think, agree that that's a basic. Then the question is, if that's true, then why would you need to put this other additional gratuitous explanation of a programming on top of an already adequate explanation for why each of us have all sinned? In the case of Adam and Eve, we know that their sin came from a contaminant in the environment coupled with the weakness of their inherent mortal flesh. Why would we ever need to suppose that in addition to that, in any other case beyond Adam and Eve, that there's some other contributing factor besides that, this additional programming factor? Scientifically, there's a principle called, I won't give the scientific name, but it has to do with the idea of not assuming additional unnecessary components of an explanation when you have a simpler explanation that adequately explains the phenomena. And so we all agree with the simple explanation. The question is, why would you need to go beyond that?
Because the simple explanation has a problem with it.
Okay.
Because Adam and Eve were not perfect. They were not made in a perfect image. They were not made perfect because they had the nature. They had the propensity, as Jason would say.
I don't know. I mean, so how do you deal with the statement of they were not made perfect versus God saying when He was done?
But you're saying morally perfect, right?
Right.
Because if God makes them and He makes them morally flawed, which is what I think you would be tantamount to saying. And aren't you making God responsible for that programming?
And saying it was present before they sinned?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is that if they're made perfect, then what's the difference in anybody else?
But you would agree that they were made in God's image, and that the image that even in the model you're suggesting is that image had to be changed by their sin and passed on. So initially, I understood you to be making a distinction between the nature they had prior to sin and the nature afterwards, and that distinction would have to be based on the idea that the nature they had initially was devoid of this moral frailty, because they were good and in God's image, whereas their children were not now because they had been tainted. Now you're suggesting that flaw in their moral frailty was there by design from the beginning. So I'm a little confused on the situation now, because it seems like you're suggesting something different than what you said before.
That's my question back to you is like I said, if they're made in the image of God, okay, then how are they made in the image of God?
I think it comes back to without free will.
Well, I think the issue here is that we have two different possible components. One is a moral component, one that says there's a moral flaw that Adam and Eve must have already before the devil comes in, which is what makes them susceptible. There's a moral flaw that's inherited by Seth, that's inherited by all of us. And it explains it in terms of a moral failing or a character issue on a moral grounds. The other option is to say that there is a weakness, but it's not a moral weakness. And that way, when God makes a man with this weakness, he's not giving them a moral weakness or a moral tainting. And that weakness, as we define it, which is not a moral issue at all, is simply that the body is mortal, it's weak, it has needs, it has desires, and that creates the possibility for a struggle when those needs or desires of the body run up against a command that God has stated. And in that way, there's no moral failing that then is attributed to God or that's inherited. We inherit mortality and its inherent weaknesses with regard to needs and wants, but we don't inherit a moral failing. So we have those two options, but I think that both of them would adequately explain what we see today, what I've experienced, what you've experienced, what men in general in the Bible records. That would be my thoughts. What kind of weakness is it? Is it a moral weakness or just a weakness in terms of capacity and strength?
You brought up Occam's razor, and I think that Occam's razor applies to what evidence we have available to us about the environment of the Garden of Eden. because you have the creation of what you have there, and then you have the humans with their mortal flesh, and you have their ability to choose. And you have other elements that we probably haven't talked about. That's the experimental environment we have. There is no other experimental environment that can be created. That is the one. And it did get a contaminant that came in and influenced it.
It's an external. I think we always have to say external factor.
External.
What
about Abel offering sacrifices and being a priest and killed? No one thinks he was guilty at that point.
Well, I mean, I think that would be like to answer this question that's sort of controversial with a potentially more controversial assertion. But I think what Jason is hitting on is like an interesting one because it gets to this issue of like
your test bed.
Because the idea is that Adam and Eve are morally innocent, but then here comes the presence of an external agent
who then introduces
to them a knowledge concept.
Yep.
And the behavioral concept that they themselves were previously innocent of and would not have necessarily otherwise have done.
And
you say that, and then when you say in Romans that Paul says, "Hutos," in the same way that Adam sinned, men sin. Meaning, they're in the same situation. They don't have this moral failing that's inherent any more than Adam did, but there's external agents around them that introduce them to moral concepts and behavioral concepts that they did not know and that then lead them astray.
Concept.
And we also have God who gave them the choice about this tree and its fruit. So if it was the nature, it wouldn't be fair for him to play the game that way.
Don, I got something
you're done. That they don't really have because of an ingrained...
Right, I agree. It wouldn't really even be a choice.
When we talk about... Occam's razor and the idea of simplicity of explanations or adequate explanations without additional components. Now, I think of, for a quick analogy, if you had an envelope with a playing card in it, let's say it was the Ace of Spades, and the question was, guess what's in the envelope? And I was able to guess that it was the Ace of Spades, but I acknowledged that I looked in the envelope. We all knew that I looked, you saw me look in the envelope. So you say, well, how did you know that what was in the envelope? And I said, magic. And you go, well, we all know you looked in the envelope. That's how you know. And you go, well, I looked in the envelope, but also magic. Nobody would accept the magic part because we already know the explanation. So if we all accept the explanation that humans, from Adam and Eve down to us, sin as a result of opportunity, the desires of the flesh, examples around us.
Don't say desires of the flesh.
Things that your body craves that may at times prompt you to want to take those
Sweet
and fulfill
food.
Them without
pleasure,
regard for God's law. If those are adequate explanations that all of us accept, why are we also throwing the magic on top of it?
Sure.
Where's the reason to suppose magic was involved? And I'm using magic. I don't mean to be belittling to it. I'm using because it works as an analogy. Why are we supposing the programming? Why is it even necessary? In the case of Adam and Eve, you had to get an external agent, the devil, involved because Adam and Eve would not have gone there on their own.
I also think, so we brought up this sort of hypothetical earlier, which was, what if you took an innocent, newborn baby, and they weren't going to be raised by humans, they were going to be raised by robots who would care for them, and they would never, there would be no environmental factor that would introduce sin. But I think you can ask that question another way, too, which is, let's say you took a newborn baby that was perfectly innocent, and theoretically didn't have any kind of sinful programming, and every time you could do this 1,000 times, every time that such a baby was put and raised by people who were sinning, what would be the likely outcome for that baby? And the answer is probably sooner or later, the baby, having seen people sin and heard of sin, by environmental factors would choose sin. And you wouldn't need the constant fact that all of these babies are sinning would not require inherited sinful nature because it would be sufficiently explained by the presence of the environmental factors.
That's good, but I'm still going to take this back to the Garden of Eden because in the same breath, the same simplest explanation for the Garden of Eden is that without the serpent coming along, it works for his analogy, and that is that they would never have sinned. The simplest explanation is they would never have sinned without the serpent coming in and introducing the concept that he did.
Certainly Scripture presents the serpent as the unnecessary...
Right.
The unnecessary cause of sin. That, in other words, the serpent couldn't just step back and go, give it a couple of years, we'll see what happens. He knew
that
the presentation
in 100 years that they were there.
It could have been,
because of the ages that Adam is when Seth is born. But in any case, Scripture presents the devil as the necessary initiator of the sinful behavior in men. Why would the devil even be necessary as the initiator if there was inherent programming that would have caused Adam and Eve to eventually sin on their own anyway? All he would have to do is just sit back.
Are we suggesting that it was 130 years when the sin happened?
Seth is 130. No, Adam's 130 when he has Seth. We don't know how long before that Cain and Abel were born. So you have a window of, let's say, 100 years from Adam's creation to, let's say, when Cain and Abel were born. That is a long period of time.
Give me a hypothetical number when
90 to 100 years.
So 90 times.
It could have been day
65.
It could have been day
rising
one.
Rising and setting of the sun been. That nobody touched the tree that was commanded not to be eaten of.
But we also have to say, it theoretically could have been day one. Well,
I mean,
day
yeah,
two. I don't think it could have happened on day one because they were created on day six,
and God
they had
they
not
good.
Sinned by the end of day six.
And then it's somewhere between there and 100.
Day two was the Sabbath day. I don't think anything bad happened on the Sabbath day of the first week. So they went at least a day and a half, or somewhere between day and a half and 100 years. Don, were you going to say something? This kind of discussion is fine, I think. I think it's useful for all of us in a number of ways. So
it's
I think the questions are good.
But it's awesome.
And it's totally fine. What John's probing and throwing out here is something that we try to do in general, which is to test to see if there are certain academic answers that have been put out there in the world, the Christian world. There's the Calvinist answer. There's our answer, which really is just a refined version of the same old free will, non-Calvinist, ancient church position. What he's saying is maybe there's something that got left out. I think that has to always be a legitimate consideration, and we're seeing if there is a real such possibility. There hasn't been a group that suggested, at least the point that John threw out there at the end, which is fine, that Adam and Eve suffered for some sort of programming issue even before sin. But, you know, we can throw stuff out there and evaluate it.
I mean,
I don't think
you take the model that John described and you talk about it not in terms of a moral component or programming, but just in terms of an inherent weakness of a mortal body, then I don't have any problem with that model because I think that it's true that God created man mortal, and in creating him mortal, there's inherent needs that the body has, and those needs give rise to desires, and those desires, when out of balance with rational response to God's commands, end up with sins. Not because there's a programming, but because of the weakness of mortality.
And the serpent plays upon that. I mean, they knew the standard, and it says that it was good for food, and it was pleasing to the eye, and it could make one wise. And he's questioning the standard, you know, he's questioning what God really said. She seemed to know it, and she knew what the command was. And so
there's also this presentation that Adam wasn't fooled, right? That if it weren't for the fact that Adam loved Eve and did not want to be separated from her, that Adam was not going to just eventually cave in to this on his own, right? That he's presented as though, like, Adam was like, almost like even when he knows that Eve has done the wrong thing, he knowingly does the wrong thing with her rather than being deceived.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have a...
It doesn't seem like he's like on the verge of failing or there's an eroding...
I think you have to think of it in terms of, did the servant just inadvertently go to Eve without intent, or did he intentionally go to Eve targeting her because he knew that Adam wouldn't go for it? Which, if that's the case, then that implies the fortitude of whatever you want to call it that God instilled in Adam to resist and to not go for it. Anyway, you look like you said...
Once again, you know... Bear with me with contextual stuff.
But sure.
So, in my imagination, I guess you could say, without any kind of complete evidence, so it's moral in the beginning, but once that fruit is taken by the hand and becomes to be eaten, it transfers from a moral to a physical. The curse becomes a physical thing from a moral thing. And that's just how I contextually always saw it in my mind. It was like a spiritual thing that, you know, that they had this propensity, not saying that they're automatically morally depraved without any hope or whatever, but they were made in God's image still with the free will of a propensity to sin, and it's a spiritual thing, though. There is still something there lacking.
By propensity, you mean like a tendency that will eventually manifest itself.
Exactly.
Okay.
Not just a capacity that may never be actuated, right? I mean, my car could probably go 120 miles per hour if I really pushed it, maybe 110. It has that capacity, but it's probably over the life of the car never going to have that happen. That's a capacity. But if we say propensity, it's like, even when I'm not attending to, sometimes the car just goes 110 miles per hour, regardless of whatever, because it has to.
We get the difference. I think John did mean propensity in that sense.
Just making sure that we're clear.
Which comes back to statements I made last week, which we disagreed upon, where I believe that I've experienced times in my life where I did not have control of a situation, that there was something there, something that I could not explain physically that overtook me in moments, which could be, as Brian put it, a series of bad choices that I made up to that point.
Developed behavior can have that effect.
But in my opinion, that wasn't the case in a few scenarios that I won't go into big detail about. But I believe I can identify with these situations in a sober mind and say, these were situations where I had absolutely
and
no
again,
control.
And again, I don't think anyone here would really dispute the possibility for that kind of thing to happen with someone. The question is,
he was talking about the car
is that magic as an explanation, or can you explain it through normal, ordinary events? For example, and this is not meant to relate to your circumstance, but a person who develops an addiction to a particular substance is going to find themselves in situations where they may not want to do it, but there's a real propensity for them to want to take of that substance. And so that's not an inherited thing they were born with. It's a result of behaviors they've developed over the course of their life.
I want to point out that in some sense we're not even disputing. If you take a person who's already engaged in sinful behavior, whatever age you want to do that at, whether or not that person has sinful programming, that's not even really in dispute.
No.
The question is whether or not they've self-programmed by habitual choices over the course of their life.
Or environmental factors.
Or... well, I mean, like, the choices you've made have programmed, you know...
Right, well,
like Microsoft has this thing called clutter, and the more that you take stuff out of your inbox and throw it into clutter, the program is smart enough to start then doing it without you. And that would be sort of self-programming, right? People in the military, I understand, can be trained to do certain things on reflex, so that when they start off, they have to be trained to do it, but by the end of the time, it's a reflex action.
Sure.
And
muscle memory.
Muscle memory, et cetera, et cetera. It's training. And so you can duplicate that seeming, I didn't exercise a conscious choice seeming scenario through training without it have to be inherited programming. And so the question is, what are the key distinguishing factors here that are going to tell us, is this self-programmed training or habit versus inherited programming? And what are those cues that would tell us which is the case?
Well,
because I don't think there's anything about the scenario that could really only be explained by means of inheritance.
Yeah, and
I'm not trying to tell you. You're like the guy that's come to the table going, I've got a theory on how this machine may work, and then we're like your peer group going, like, here's some questions or here's some things that would have to be defined. So
probing it, testing it.
Well, here's what
yes.
we've come. What
yeah,
no we've done? We tried to put the machine together.
Right.
I think finally, my point leads up to the whole talk we have about, you know, I use the word loosely, but dispensationalism, as we've kind of talked about it, as how I would categorize it, that there's these different covenants over different periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
So with that being coming into play here, so we're to say that Jesus is teaching to a crowd of people. At that time, there's a covenant in place that's not the new covenant.
Correct.
So he's potentially teaching to someone a way to be that's not the way they are, and they would be considered righteous if they were following something abstract to what he was actually teaching at that moment.
I'm not sure that I agree with it. I'm not sure that I understand it. I'm trying to. I'm not sure that I agree with it.
They're still operating under the old covenant and doing the old covenant things, but he's teaching them a new covenant. They go home, and they're still doing the old covenant stuff. They come back. You know,
there could be
the intertestamental period is what we're talking about.
Yeah,
a 3-year period of time between the start of Jesus' ministry and his death on the cross and resurrection.
Yeah, I mean, to me that's just
sort of inaugurated that covenant.
Hold on. Yeah, but that's
we're
later.
Trying to
come up before that.
John, I'm trying to understand what John's question is.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, John. Keep going.
I'm just saying that, like, if I look at it in that sense, and then I look back to the law, right? We talk about how if the law is a tutor that leads us to Christ, like, we learn, we acknowledge sin now, right? Because of the law... we were talking about Paul, right? You were talking about Paul last week and about how
that's what allows us to see the sin, potentially, right? Am I saying that correctly?
It is. Once the law is given, the law becomes the primary instrument of instructing about sin, but it was not the only means.
But it's like a resource or a tool, right?
Yes, but there were other resources and tools prior to the law.
Right.
As long as we stipulate that, then we're fine.
But I mean, I guess that's what's hard for me. It's weird for me. It's almost like being in the Matrix, because I'm thinking like, okay, they're in this covenant, but this new covenant, why isn't Jesus talking anywhere in the scripture about how he pulled a certain sect of the crowd away and said, hey, now I'm really talking about this new covenant thing, but hey, you guys are doing good right now, you know? As long as you keep up with the stuff you're doing right now, you're good.
Well, I think what he's doing is twofold. One, he's telling the masses that they have failed with regard to the current covenant, and that had been stated by the prophets leading up to that. And then second of all, I do think he's pulling a certain group aside and telling them, here's what's really going to happen. I mean, he didn't widely proclaim his own death and resurrection, but he did proclaim to his disciples on occasion that he was going to fulfill that statement in the prophets. And
there's other parables where he's talking about the, I think very closely to the idea of the transmission of authority from the religious leaders who inherited it from Moses to his followers. And he says something to the crowds, and then the disciples ask him, he tells them, what I'm telling you is this. There's also the case that I think the Sermon on the Mount comes very close to a public statement to that effect, where he's saying, you've heard Moses say this, but I'm telling you this is what's going to be the case. I'm going to fulfill the intent of the law, which is to extract, to get righteousness.
I'm talking about the anomaly that would be there, right? Those that are, you know, counted righteous, you know, during that time period without, you know, say they died in that middle of that time period. They didn't make it till Jesus ascended, right?
Right.
So, you know, what would they be doing, or what would their covenant be? What would they be following that would be different from the covenant that Jesus was
So in our view, the answer is always a question of knowledge, right? So even when we talk about the inheritance of the stuff, we're talking about examples and external factors that bring you knowledge. Even as Paul says, his understanding came from the law. His understanding of sin came from the knowledge of the law. But it would depend on what, you know, are you talking about someone living somewhere and they're Jewish, but do they have knowledge of Jesus coming in his teaching? Or are they one of the people that sat there while this guy was teaching and rejected him? Because they're going to be...
Don't you still think that prior to Jesus' resurrection that... and so this will give you an opportunity to correct where I'm not understanding you, but prior to his resurrection and the inauguration of the new covenant with the various things that went along with it, that they would be counted as righteous for fulfilling the law of Moses. Isn't that...
The moment that Christ gets anointed by John the Baptist and goes forward preaching, anybody who heard him and rejected that, even prior to his covenant being inaugurated, in my opinion, according to what Moses says in Deuteronomy, what Moses says, that prophet shall you hear in everything, and he who doesn't, it will be required of him.
Sure.
Moses is telling us, from the minute this guy goes forward preaching, if you're the type of person that's rejecting the types of teaching that this guy's had, if you have the misfortune of dying at that point in time, you're in trouble.
Because that would ultimately be a failure under the law of Moses. So that's
right, because Moses is saying this law is going to be in effect until the guy comes forward that replaces it. And the minute he starts teaching you, you need to do what he says. And if you don't, it's going to be required of you.
And it's a violation of the law of Moses not to follow.
And by the way, it's not such an anomalous situation, because in mass, the same problem would have happened the moment that Moses came and the covenant with Israel went forth to Israel. You would have had a period of time where the Israelites had to learn those. That's just the Israelites. By the way, the rest of the world, who had up to that point only had the covenant and the commands of Noah, would also have suddenly been in a transitional period here, because now there's a new standard going forth. So, yes, it's a sort of strange three-year period when Jesus is involved in his ministry before his death and resurrection and inaugurates the new covenant, but it's not anomalous in the sense that this type of thing hasn't happened on a grander scale elsewhere in history. There's always these kind of anomalies whenever the covenant changes.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask how you were relating this to this larger question of the sinful nature, though. I get that we've talked about the changes in covenants and the effects of sin, but
I guess to me it comes back to, you know, we talked a little bit, I think the last time you were here, about legalism, right? So, you know, I've always perceived it that way, to be following the law, and in some ways it's being put, people that were in dispensations were falling, you know, under that covenant, but still, they're following a set of rules.
Sure.
So it almost, to me, seems like the word legalism goes alongside of some of that talk. So when I look at that talk, then I'm saying, well, what about this person who's perceived as legalist? They're in a crowd, Jesus comes up to speak, and they're torn between, do I
follow this guy or do I continue to follow?
I think the New Testament presents their dilemma differently, because I think it presents that people who were zealous for the law,
like
whether
Paul.
James speaks of it, or Paul, or Nicodemus, or Joseph of Arimathea, and were under the law of Moses, some of whom were even involved in the Sanhedrin court, when they heard Jesus speak and they were serious about the law of Moses, they were compelled to accept Jesus. They didn't find themselves in this dilemma of going, well, I can either follow Moses or I can follow this Jesus guy and abandon Moses. They seem to find harmony between the two, because I think Moses anticipates and points them towards Jesus. Jesus says, the law, prophets, it's all pointing towards me. So I don't think those guys were in that kind of dilemma.
The general trend where I think Jesus says, look, my sheep hear my voice, right? So the idea is that if you've followed faithfully, and there may be exceptions to this. I mean, I think Paul in some ways is an exception. He's the only person we know that God ever knocks off of a donkey in order to convert them. But most other people have to be persuaded through means that don't involve an appearance from the Lord that makes you blind for several days. But otherwise, the general trend is, if you are the kind of person that is faithful to the law of Moses, when Christ comes, you would have listened to him and
heard
his
statement that the law is pointing towards and instructing and anticipating and directing people towards Christ, so that when he shows up, they're supposed to follow him. Not that the two are headed in different directions and someone's like, I'm over here following what God said. What's this Jesus guy? What? Do I gotta... It's, they're headed like this. One is running you into the other. So you really shouldn't have this dilemma. So I'm not sure if that's...
Yeah, the problem of the Jews is that they went out of the way and didn't follow Jesus.
But
they created their
going
own
that other way.
Way.
They were not following
Correct.
Moses and going away from Jesus.
Jesus criticizes them for...
They had following Moses.
They kept
yeah, modifying
Jesus
Moses down through the centuries. And by the time Jesus shows up and Moses is pointing to him, they're way over here.
Anyway,
I mean, I think
wasn't trying to say that so much as that it was a dilemma, but that there
sure.
could potentially be a possibility that someone didn't follow Jesus, but still was unclaimed to be righteous because they were following the law of Moses.
That's certainly true. I think they would have been accepted if they were trying to follow the law of Moses and being faithful to that, but there was some disconnect where they didn't know about Jesus or hadn't heard correctly about Jesus and weren't exposed to that information. I think that God would have accepted them for their heart being in the right place. But if they were confronted by Jesus and had a good possibility to know who he was and resisted that...
But let's talk
God
about a third possibility, which is... Let's say a guy like Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea, right? They're clearly presented as, personally, they're persuaded by Jesus' teachings. However, they are also sort of playing it kind of close, right? They're not outright confronting the other religious leaders. They're not outright members of the 12 apostles. So maybe there are, as a group, that is, even Paul, where he considers himself later in the New Testament to have been a faithful Jew, but then persecuted the followers of Christ, that are faithful to Judaism, but are wavering in that period. What is their status? I think that's the critical case, right? And I think the answer is, if you're wavering, if you're persuaded that this guy's words are true in and of yourself, but you're wavering because you're afraid of the reaction of the community, and you just happen to be unfortunate enough to get struck by a moving camel, you know, it's on you. I mean, that you're going to be in trouble because now you're fearing God more than your own conscience.
Distract people with these jokes.
I know, but my point is that...
I know your joke,
the point is that that is a person who fears God, fears men, potentially, in that moment, more than the approval of God, which
sure.
is something that's brought up repeatedly in Scripture as a problem. And so despite their faithfulness to the law of Moses, and despite their sort of tacit, non-committal... being persuaded by Jesus, I think if they died in that moment, they would be in potential serious trouble because they're still more motivated.
If someone was honestly, you know, take Nicodemus, open to the possibility of Jesus being the one Moses pointed to, and was honestly waiting to find out and listening and considering, and happened to die before Jesus rose from the dead, I think that would be okay, as long as he wasn't for resisting Jesus close for the wrong reasons. If he's like, I think there might be something to this guy. I'm not fully persuaded. Let's see where this goes. I'm on board. I'm listening. I'm paying attention. I'm trying to understand it. And he happens to die.
I
think he'd be covered.
I think he'd be okay, too.
Being just and fair? I mean, if you're giving...
It depends.
Yeah,
what we're saying is, you can't... It's going to depend on what's keeping that guy from diving headlong into being a disciple.
I'm not sure that we're conversing the thing that he's intending to bring up.
First John, test all the spirits. There's going to be a period of testing going on there.
But even though we're talking about a lot of hypotheticals here, hopefully what we're demonstrating is there are viable explanations for what happens in these circumstances that would not require anything along the lines of an inherited programming or something like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, that question of why do we need to suggest an additional or alternative explanation when we all agree of the adequacy of the concept of environmental factors contributing. You don't need it. Does Scripture actually directly attest to it? Places like, for example, Genesis 5:3 don't, in my estimation, come close to being a biblical clear statement to that effect. It may be correspondent to that idea, if you like, but it doesn't actually necessitate it. And so, again, I think we're drawn back to the conclusion that we all know that I know the car because we all saw me look in the envelope. We don't need for me to suggest the alternative option that I'm clairvoyant. And the same thing with the sinful nature. We all know that we all sin as a result of environmental factors, opportunities, and the flesh that has needs. We don't need the additional programming. The other things are adequate in the case of Adam and Eve and the rest of us.
This would be the last thing I say, and we're over an hour. You would also have to explain things such as in the Law of Moses, but also present in the New Testament, in which God commands them to quickly remove anybody engaged in sinful behavior so that it doesn't take root. Because that fear is pretty much totally extraneous and misleading if they're all going to, by programming inherited from Adam, sin anyway.
The contaminant is already
present. It's unavoidable. You don't have to...
Can you say that again?
Yeah, yeah. So passages in the Old Testament or even in the New Testament where God is saying, you must quickly remove sinful people. If there's a false prophet that comes, tries to lead you astray, stone him. Put that evil out of Israel. If there's fornication, put that evil quickly out of Israel so that it doesn't take root, right? There's that kind of connotation that God's like trying to keep, he's playing whack-a-mole in some sense. He doesn't want anything, don't let anything get up long enough for it to take root. And that implies that there is no current root or inherent programming. That it's the environmental factors that God's trying to say, if you shut down all the environmental factors, you will be able to remain faithful to these teachings. If you let them pop up, and you don't get rid of them, then pretty soon you're all going to be doing the wrong thing, and I'm going to have to expel you out of this land. And I think that undercurrent in the Law of Moses itself is a proof. And this is probably why Jews to this day don't believe in these types of sinful nature things, because they believe that sin is something that can be avoided, and that God was teaching them here's ways to keep you from going astray. And there was no programming that was a threat to cause them automatically to go astray already.
Sure. So, and we can certainly continue to talk about it. We didn't get to any of the notes that we had for tonight, so we will have
the longest review.
Totally okay to do this. In fact, the more this happens, the better, as long as they're good exercises and constructive. Brian and I would both welcome that. So we will have another week next week. We can continue tonight if people will have time to stick around to follow through on some of these conversations.
I'm going to stop us now.
Sure, me too.